If you want to fulfill your potential or help other people fulfill their potential so you can feel great and get the rewards and respect you deserve, then I want to give you a free physical copy of my new best-selling book, because you deserve to know the truth. The most important things for fulfilling your potential are not tips, tricks, hacks, therapy, coaching, meditation, breathwork, goal setting, journaling, or finding your why. I know it sounds irrational because we're so used to hearing about using these things to help us fulfill our potential. But these approaches are outdated and ineffective, and they are based on a big lie.
To find out more and get your free physical copy of Dr. John Finn's best-selling book, The Habit Mechanic, go to tougherminds.co.uk. Hello, it's another Tougher Minds podcast, and this week we're going to be talking about how teaching improvements in universities can lead to them gaining extra funding. That's a new announcement that's been made recently, and how Tougher Minds fits into that. We're also going to be talking about transitions in education, specifically around the Year 7 age group and the connection with the forthcoming European Football Championships. But we're going to start by reminding you and refreshing your mind with some of the tips that Tougher Minds can provide for exam success. I'm joined once again by Tougher Minds founder and managing director, Dr. John Finn. John, hello there. It's that time. It's half term for many. And then after that, we're straight into it. Exams for many, many young people. We've spoken in recent weeks, and Tougher Minds has released some very popular material in recent times with advice on how to prepare for exams, exam revision advice. But still not too late, I don't suppose, to help yourself in certain ways in terms of performance on the day and the last stages of revision.
No. Exams are going to go on for quite a few weeks to come, so certainly you can still accumulate knowledge and get good at showing that you understand that knowledge in an exam format. So I'm sure that for lots of young people, they're doing more revision now than they've ever done before in their lives. So it's not too late.
Would you say, John, that as well as the exams unfold, you know, you may have taken an exam, you may have sat your first exam already, it's important to bear in mind that it's still possible to develop and revise for forthcoming exams you haven't yet sat. And if you think you've performed badly in your first exam, you're still in the game, as it were. You're still live with a chance to perform in your forthcoming exams.
Yeah, but I think the key here is to take one exam at a time, you know, focus on the process. You can't change anything that's happened in the past. What you can do is learn from things that have happened in the past. In our programmes, we really encourage people to reflect in a constructive way. So we kind of draw from understanding from the world of positive psychology, and in particular Barbara Fredrickson's work on flourishing and languishing, and lots of data pointing towards an understanding that people who flourish, who do really well in life, for every unhelpful experience or emotion they experience, they manage to find three helpful ones. So it's talked about this 3-to-1 ratio, and we kind of encourage people to reflect on that ratio when they've done something. So what's the thing that you could have improved in that situation, but equally, what did you do well? Sometimes that ratio needs to go up to as high as 11-to-1. But our brain gets drawn to the unhelpful things that have gone on. So the Fredrickson's approach is called grounded positivity, because we need some negativity to keep us progressing and improving. And in this case, you know, if our first exam was perfect, it's probably not much we can learn from it. So it's good to make a mistake, but you've got to learn from it. But we mustn't underestimate how much attention the brain pays to the negative, to the unhelpful. You know, we know that from adult research, kind of in the business world, that if your day is bad enough, that you write down in your diary, I had a bad day today, it takes you 3 days to cognitively recover. So what we understand is that emotionally, when we have a stressful event that happens to us, which might be an exam, that the clever part of our brain shuts down because it gets overwhelmed. When I say the clever part of our brain, I mean our prefrontal cortex. It shuts down because it gets overwhelmed with unhelpful emotions, which are essentially chemicals, neurotransmitters, and your brain just becomes occupied with the thing that went poorly. So I think a really good habit around exams is, after you've finished an exam, you know, reflecting it, and it doesn't have to be as simple as 3-1. You can draw two columns up: what went well, what can I learn next time? You know, and the thing is to take forward the thing that you can learn next time. It might be the way that you approached questions that you didn't understand. It might be how well you managed the timing of the exam. It might be what you did directly before the exam or in the 24 hours before the exam. So there's lots of things that we can learn from events in life, and in this case, exams.
So you would advise young people then, perhaps they come home from the school hall where they've had their first exam and, you know, walked home with their friends maybe or on their own, to literally sit down and just have that moment of reflection, or a few moments of reflection, actually make notes. And then would it be perhaps useful to discuss that as well with a parent or guardian, just to cement that in your thinking?
Yeah, I think the important point you raised there is walking home. I think exercising after an exam is important because it acts as a good reflection tool. That could be a walk, it could be a run. It just helps you to clear the mind, so to speak, and to take some of the unhelpful chemicals out of your brain. Writing down definitely, yeah, is that writing down helps us to pay attention to what we're thinking about and not just let it wander around in our mind. Talking to a parent would be great as well, I guess, or parent or guardian. I guess different people have different relationships with their parents, so in some cases that might add stress, but in others it might help the stress. So yeah, but I think we use this word reflection, but there's, you know, reflection happens on a continuum. You can reflect really poorly on something, or you can reflect really well on something. You know, and I think a really solid reflection has to involve writing something down and spending some sustained time thinking about it.
So, I mean, that method, though, if you did that after every exam, you would almost, in a way, I suppose, then be able to inoculate yourself against the after effects of a bad day and be recharged and ready to go for your next one. Even if you felt exam one went badly and then, unfortunately, exam two went badly, you might have another 4 or 5 to sit. You can still reset yourself for what's to come.
Yeah, well, you know, inoculation is a process, and it's not you're not going to do something once and get good at it. You know, we get good at what we practice. So if you keep practicing getting stressed out after your exams and before them, you're going to get really good at getting stressed out before and after your exams. If you practice reflecting on your exams, and before you reflect, putting some perspective on it by, you know, going for a walk or a run, then you're going to get good at reflecting and get good at managing difficult events potentially, but also learning from them and doing better the next time. That's what we're trying to do.
Well, I think that's a great mechanism for young people to take away and take with them into the exam period, the idea then of reflecting and taking positives and positive learning from the experience you've just had that day. And let's hope people can do that and use it to enhance their performances in their exams. So is there anything then that can be done in the immediate build-up to an exam, the hour or the half hour before or the minutes before? What can you do as we approach kickoff, to use a sporting metaphor?
Well, it's certainly advantages can be taken away from. You can be advantaged or disadvantaged, I would suggest, by what you do in that immediacy to an exam. To understand some of the science of that, we know that brain function seems to be aided by exercise, sleep and diet, and there seems to be a protein, which is what quite important for brain function, called brain-derived neurotrophic factor, which is connected to good diet and certainly exercise. So if you want to go into the exam with a brain full of BDNF, you know, incorporating some exercise, maybe some light exercise into your routine would be helpful. I think that that will help you to manage your stress as well a little bit by using up what you might understand in layman's terms as nervous energy. I think also in that period of time, you've got to think about getting yourself ready to sit in an exam hall for probably up to 2 hours. So for some people, that's easy to concentrate for that period of time. Others, it's not. I think exams are contextual. Sometimes they're in the morning, sometimes in the afternoon. You've got to think about what you're going to be doing in the exam. It's really a retrieval exercise. So you have to get good at, you know, you have to practice retrieving information. So I think that as an individual going into an exam, first and foremost, you have to think about what's going to be useful for you in that period of time. Don't just conform to what your friends do. You know, think about a kind of a pre-exam routine that's going to help you to go into the exam and be ready when the timer starts to answer the first question as well as you can.
Yeah, well, we hope that young people can do that. And I think if they look at the Tougher Minds website, tougherminds.co.uk, there's certainly some good tips on there, especially in the video section. There's been some blogs released in recent weeks with good tips for revision from, you know, a few weeks away or maybe a week before the exam period. And I think your tips and your help you've just described there will be extremely useful for anybody entering what can be a testing period. And we wish everyone all the best and good luck, and stick with the Tougher Minds tips, and we think you will be well served by those. We spoke at the start then about our other two topics, and we'll come on to the next one, which is there was an announcement made very recently that universities in the UK would perhaps be able to access a greater level of funding if they could demonstrate the efficacy and the effectiveness of their teaching, and how that translates to academic achievement in degree courses for undergraduates, etc. Obviously, an important period again for anybody studying for a degree, something that can really advance your career, and important that you get the best possible experience and I suppose takeaway from your university years. But I know you feel, John, Tougher Minds could support universities to really enhance and refine what they deliver to their students.
If you want to fulfill your potential or help other people fulfill their potential so you can feel great and get the rewards and respect you deserve, then I want to give you a free physical copy of my new best-selling book, because you deserve to know the truth. The most important things for fulfilling your potential are not tips, tricks, hacks, therapy, coaching, meditation, breathwork, goal setting, journaling, or finding your why. I know it sounds irrational because we're so used to hearing about using these things to help us fulfill our potential. But these approaches are outdated and ineffective, and they are based on a big lie.
To find out more and get your free physical copy of Dr. John Finn's best-selling book, The Habit Mechanic, go to tougherminds.co.uk.
Yeah, well, we've worked with some lecturers before on this, so we know that it has good impact. I think, you know, having been a university lecturer and having lots of friends who are as well, and being to university myself, it's challenging. It's kind of the lecture piece, the seminar piece. It's often people who are in universities, academics, they're there because they're interested in, they're doing their research and not necessarily teaching. people about their areas. But increasingly, as more and more people have gone to university, there's more and more of a responsibility for academics to be able to teach. I guess lectures are seen as a cheap way to educate, actually get as many people in a room as possible and give them an introduction to an idea and then let them go away and explore that idea further. But I think the expectations of the students is changing, and that's not good enough anymore. Students are looking for more in the way of higher quality delivery, and therefore the government are kind of stepping in to say, yeah, that we support that idea and you're going to be rewarded if you can do it. And actually, I was just speaking to a university professor, and I understand that actually they're going to get punished if they don't as well, because their ability to charge fees won't just be able to increase if they're doing well, it will decrease if they're not doing well. So I think that to understand why lecture teaching is problematic, we have to think about how the brain learns in the first instance. And what is increasingly understood is that the brain is a visual, the brain likes pictures. So we've seen a lot of understanding about learning styles in education over a long period of time. And this will upset some people, what I'm going to say now is, but the big research does not support learning styles in the way that it's portrayed in education. The research shows that our eyes are the dominant sense, and vision has been absolutely essential for evolution. And if we look at the sensory cortex, we see that up to a third of it is dominated by vision. So pictures are very important for the way that we learn. And it's kind of understood that an optimal learning experience for us, beyond real, you know, live interaction with people talking about things, would be a Hollywood movie, because it's got the pictures, 3D moving kind of pictures in it. Does that make sense, Andrew?
It does. I think I can hear students all over the country delighted that they're going to be going to the cinema every Wednesday instead of having to sit through Professor What's His Name's 90 minutes drolling on. But no, I'm sure you mean something slightly more serious than that, John. But I'm interested in what you say about visual learning and how might that actually translate then. Say, I mean, my memory of university, on occasions I was part of lectures that seemed like I was, you know, almost part of a small football stand. You know, there were banks of people, and one person at the front delivering, usually with some form of large screen. There wasn't the fundamental issue of not being able to see or hear, but nevertheless, you did feel a bit remote from it. So how might a more visually enhanced experience function?
Well, the technology such as Prezi is very powerful here, if we use it in a visually dominant way. So using things like pictures and videos is very powerful. Often the technique we see in lectures is PowerPoints full of bullet points and writing.
Yeah.
And it turns out the brain can't read and listen at the same time. So that's a futile idea of presenting information. So you can't read the bullet points and listen to what the person's saying at the same time, because reading and listening work on different loops in the brain. So it seems a lot of the traditional style when I say that, it's probably not the traditional style. I think it's a style that technology has imposed on educators, because actually what they used to do was chalk and talk. And I can remember lessons at school where, teachers would bring the dullest concept alive with a chalkboard and a multi-coloured chalks, drawing and, really giving you the detail. And I can still see them bouncing around now. Whereas technology's come in and I think we just use it incorrectly. We're not sure how to use it. But I think that another important point that you pick up on is the emotional connection to the person who's delivering. And that seems to be the most important thing when we're learning something, is that we think that the person who's delivering it cares about us and they're interested in us. And of course, the bigger the audience is, the more difficult that is. And I think that as university programs have grown, that sort of one-to-one pastoral support has also eroded, so that the lecturer giving the big lecture. One time would have had quite close relationships with lots of the students in the audience. I think, oh, that's eroding away as well. You know, just using simple tricks like asking people's names and showing positive body language, not shooting people down when they answer a question in the wrong ways, are all important things to use when you're teaching. We've developed this tool called the Expands Learning Plan, which is a plan for that we use in our own delivery, and it's a plan to help you to kind of hit all the optimal learning, human learning functions within your lesson, so that you can really make sure you're doing everything that you can to help everyone in your audience learn. And in fact, last week when we were up in Scotland, the professor commented in her feedback that she's really considering her own teaching style based on the style that we were using, because she saw that the engagement that I had with the students. So, you know, I think the format of lecturing has lots of problems within it, but with some insight into how people learn, how people concentrate, and how then people retain information, there are ways to supercharge that process. And I think often for people working in universities, if they can understand the science behind these often simple and practical ideas, they're more likely to deploy them, you know, in their teaching.
But, and presumably as well, if a university or an institution had this insight and had a policy then of adopting it and integrating it consistently across all its delivery, the people delivering would be naturally supported by perhaps new audiovisual tools and some new guidelines about how to deliver. So it would be it would become second nature in due course.
Yeah, it's building the habit. In fact, we're talking to a university at the moment about them using our process. And the first point is that every new member of staff, they will be trained or made aware of this process and be informed that this is the way we want you to work with our students. You know, change management is difficult in big organisations, as you know, and you don't want to give people a doctrine of how they should or shouldn't teach, but what you can do is inform them of how humans learn and ask them to do their utmost to try to match their approach with that understanding.
Yeah, well, it's certainly something the way that you've described the potential pitfalls of the current system certainly rings true with my experience of university education, and I'm sure it will for many others as well. And I know you're going to be releasing more details of the Expands programme very soon, so anybody who wants to look at that in greater detail, keep an eye on the Tougher Minds website, tougherminds.co.uk. You can go on there and sign up for updates. There are some great free resources to download, so head to tougherminds.co.uk to download those free resources and sign up, and you can be made aware of the releases of new services and information from Tougher Minds. You can also follow Tougher Minds on Twitter as well. At Tougher Minds is the handle. So please do that. And that's another channel through which Tougher Minds will let people know about new exciting developments. Okay, John, well, our final topic then for this podcast. We spoke about the big football tournament this summer. It could be another summer of heartache for English soccer fans, but there's other UK interests as well this time. Wales, Ireland and Northern Ireland involved in the Euro 2016 in France. So it will be a fascinating sporting summer for all the couch potatoes among us. And of course, I'm sure you will see cars adorned with England flags and what have you. But the tournament provides a useful starting point, I think, for a discussion about transitions in your career, in your education specifically. And I believe you would use the example of one Mr. Jamie Vardy, who's potentially set to star for England, and the way his career's developed and stalled and then restarted, and of course very famously enjoyed a great moment recently with Leicester City's Premier League win. His pathway, as it were, provides a useful parallel for some insight Tougher Minds has into successfully managing transitions in the education sphere.
Sure. Well, my PhD is on transition, so I've got some insight into them. I think Jamie Vardy's very interesting, isn't he? He got released from Sheffield Wednesday as a 16-year-old and then navigated his way back into the Premier League, which isn't how it's supposed to be. You know, the football development system isn't set up for that to happen. It's set up for the best young players to go into the best academies and then for those young players to transit into the best teams, you know, and play at the highest level. Whereas Jamie Vardy, I think, has been the first person for quite a while to book that trend. Although I think there's a couple of Leicester City players actually are in the same understanding of career progression, probably slightly less dramatic than Jamie Vardy's. I think what is clear from the sort of transition research is what you can do today does not predict what you can do in 5 years' time. And we're starting to understand this more clearly in the talent development areas. You know, actually what predicts what you can do from 5 years' time from today is what you practice. And Jamie Vardy's clearly put in a lot of high-quality practice in between being released from Sheffield Wednesday and, you know, winning the Premiership with Leicester this year. And I think that we can learn lessons from that in the educational domain as well. You know, we talked last week about mindset. And at the moment, just to contextualise this, my PhD work is actually from teenage transitions to becoming an adult in very elite sport or elite sport. But we're taking some of these ideas and we're putting them into year seven transition programmes in both the private and the state school sector in the UK. And, you know, when someone is 11 years old, potentially they've already been written off are either academic ability. They've been told that they're not particularly good at maths and they're not particularly good at that thing and they'll probably never get good at that thing. And what transitions really are they're challenge points for people. And it seems that the people who manage transitions the best are able to regulate their emotions and not keep paying attention to the fixed mindset idea of you've either got it or you've not. They can get into growth mindset mode and they can regulate their emotions and keep persisting and keep practicing and keep refining their skill at the things that they want to get better at. And in our year seven transition programs, that's what we're teaching. We're teaching these young people that actually most of the things that they're able to do when they're 11, they've had to learn how to do them, because when you're a baby, you can't do much and you practice and practice and practice and get good at all the things that you can do. And that if they want to get better at things, the challenges on the horizon when they go to secondary school, for example, the same rules apply, you know. We teach them simple and practical strategies that they can use to try to overcome the challenges in their life, whether they're school or extracurricular or social or related to more basic concepts like their sleep, their diet, their exercise. So, yes, I can certainly see the parallels between the Jamie Vardy story and, you know, booking the trend of you've either got it or you haven't. That understanding isn't supported by a lot of very good scientific data. It says if you want to get good, you need to put in a heck of a lot of practice. You know, and the starting point of that argument is that whatever your ability levels are now, with high quality practice, you can get better.
And it's been said then that I think reading around the Jamie Vardy story, as it were, that his time in the lower leagues, because I think, as you say, he was jettisoned by a football league club, Sheffield Wednesday, with hopes that he would be a high profile member of their squad. And obviously they're now challenging for promotion back into the Premier League as we record this and are always there or thereabouts, even though they have been in the lower divisions. They're a big club by any definition. But then he was cast aside, as you say, and his time in the lower leagues afforded him the opportunity to practice the skills of a striker, it's being said, you know, with less pressure on him, if you like. Is that how he obtained his opportunity to practice and develop as a striker, do you think?
Yes, but I think so getting game time is one thing for sure. You know, this talk is in the of introducing another professional league, which I think would allow some of the Premiership's academy teams to be playing competitive, more adult competitive football. That's a model which is used in Italy. I think the second division is often the B team of some of the biggest clubs. But there's a difference between being given game time and actually using it really constructively. And you know, most development for footballers isn't done on the field, it's done off the field. You know, if you're not doing the hard work off the field to improve the many skills that contribute to becoming a good striker, then just working hard on the field isn't going to create huge development opportunities for you. You've got to do them both in conjunction. And, you know, Jamie Vardy showed that if you've got the dedication to improving yourself, and you've got the skills to be able to push through difficult times and to practice really efficiently and effectively, you know, then you can get better and you can, you know, fulfil a level of potential that some people never thought you would. So it's not just having the opportunity, it's also about taking the opportunity and making the most use of it.
And how does that, how would that then be paralleled with young people, you know, facing a transition from school to school or from a different section of the school at, around the age of 11? What if Jamie Vardy had to adhere to good practice and practice harder, what might young people have to do to successfully transition through their school careers?
Well, different things for different pupils, but I think the core element is that you've got to keep persisting and you've got to keep engaging in the process. So you might go to your secondary school, find it all ever so overwhelming. And that means in every lesson you go to, most lessons you just disengage, you're not really paying attention to what the teacher says, you know, looking out the window, you're not doing your homework. So you stop practicing the subjects, you know. And that might be the same for a particular subject that someone's found difficult, they don't get on with the teacher, you know, from the orphaned. What happens is you can very quickly get left behind in the educational setting. So that the things you need to learn in order to get your GCSEs and give you that, you know, better chance of progressing onto the other things later in life, you can get left behind in year seven because you disengage essentially, because it's overwhelming for you or you're not interested. So it all comes back to persisting. But to do that, you need to have some understanding of how to do it. You know, and you need to, first and foremost, have that belief system that you can change, you can get better. But as we alluded to last week, you need the skills to be able to do that. And that's what we're teaching in our sort of year seven transition programs. Not just in year seven, we do that across the educational sector. But I think that increasingly that year seven transition has been identified as a potentially challenging one for young people. And in fact, if you want to teach them these kind of skills, why not start at that age or if not even younger?
And you have had great success and a good take-up, I believe, with these programmes at more than one school.
Yes, we're running the year seven transition, the year seven transition at two schools, actually, a private school and a state school. And, you know, they've recognised that year sevens need more than what they're currently getting. And actually, to my annoyance, I'm hearing this, we give them mindfulness, you know. Mindfulness is a fantastic tool, but it's not a solution to managing transitions. You know, mindfulness is a self-awareness tool, and it can be just as dangerous as it can be useful. Now, there's a lot of report coming out at the moment, the negative side of mindfulness, which always happens when the media get interested in something because they want to then get another story out of it and say that it's dangerous. But, you know, people are reporting that mindfulness can be overwhelming for them because they're being made aware of what's going on for them to a greater degree than they ever have been before without necessarily being given the skills to manage that. So it can be daunting and overwhelming and stressful, all the things it's not supposed to be. So we need to make young people aware, more self-aware, educate them that if they practice, they can get better, aligned with kind of growth mindset ideas. But then we need to give them the skills to manage themselves. And I think currently we're not doing that particularly well.
Well, if people want to know about how Tougher Minds can help with school transitions and much more besides, they again should head to the website, tougherminds.co.uk. Please have a look, watch the videos, read the blogs and sign up for some of the free resources available. And you'll learn more about what the Tougher Minds programme is and how it's been so effective in business, sport and education in recent times, and with many future projects to come as well. John, thanks for joining us once again. And to everyone, thanks for listening.
If you want to fulfill your potential or help other people fulfill their potential so you can feel great and get the rewards and respect you deserve, then I want to give you a free physical copy of my new best-selling book, because you deserve to know the truth. The most important things for fulfilling your potential are not tips, tricks, hacks, therapy, coaching, meditation, breathwork, goal setting, journaling, or finding your why. I know it sounds irrational because we're so used to hearing about using these things to help us fulfill our potential. But these approaches are outdated and ineffective, and they are based on a big lie.
To find out more and get your free physical copy of Dr. John Finn's best-selling book, The Habit Mechanic, go to tougherminds.co.uk.